4. Bohemial Rising, 1985-1990. Lorne Michaels had wanted to take 6 months off at the end of the 1979-80 season of Saturday Night Live so he could rethink and recast the show. Instead, as things turned out, Lorne's half-year hiatus turned into a 5-year exile. Unfortunately, the creator's return was not an immediate raise-the-roof triumph. He had an act to follow for a change, the Billy Crystal Martin Short Saturday Night Live, which had been a populist hit. Instead of scouring comedy clubs and improv groups for fresh young talent, as he and his cohorts had done the first time, Michaels, as if borrowing a page from the Ebersol playbook, stocked the show with the known and near-known. Veteran actor Randy Quaid, teenage star Anthony Michael Hall, who had played Chevy Chase's son in National Lampoon's Vacation, young actors Robert Downey Jr. and Joan Cusack, newcomers Terry Sweeney and Denitra Vance. It was a more peculiar than colorful group, one that writers found it difficult to write sketches for. Among the saving graces, though, were eccentric newcomer John Lovitz, a male diva who popularized original characters like his pathological liar and master thespian, performer Nora Dunn, whose SNL stint would end in public acrimony, and snide Dennis Miller, who turned Weekend Update into his own fitfully amusing soapbox, replete with cranky ranting, girlish giggling, and a hailstorm of obscure references, one of his favorite and more accessible being the character Boo, played silently by Robert Duvall in To Kill a Mockingbird. Michaels was not completely bedecked in glory. His much ballyhooed foray into primetime TV, a tastefully inert variety hour called The New Show, was apparently not new enough. It lasted fewer than 13 weeks in the 1984-85 TV season. Not only were the ratings puny, but Michaels experienced his first true trouncing from the critics. He also lost, by his estimate, more than $1 million of his own money. In addition, what had been envisioned as a prestigious and productive movie career, first abortively at Warner Brothers and then at Paramount, fell short of expectations and momentarily threatened his reputation as king of the comedy impresarios. Now, Michaels had to build a new mountain and didn't have much raw material to do it with. He was in somewhat the predicament that Gene Dumanian had been, except he had all those connections and a keen eye for talent. All that was on the line were his personal and professional reputation, his livelihood, and the fate of his life's most important creation. Tom Hanks, host. I did the show for the first time in 1985, the year Lorne came back after being away for 5 years, and I asked him, "So why did you come back?" And he just said, "I missed it." Bernie Brillstein, manager. Lorne Michaels loves a lot of things. He's not in love with anything but Saturday Night Live. That's it. It's that simple. That's why he came back. Herb Sargent, writer. The season before Lorne's return, Brandon called me, and he said he was on the fence between Dick and Lorne, between Dick staying and Lorne coming back. I said, "If you have Ebersol, you have a solid professional show. If you have Lorne, you have something unexpected, which is much more fun than anything." Lorne Michaels, executive producer. The reality hit me that I needed a job. I wasn't really focused on much other than Three Amigos. I had spent the better part of 1984 writing it with Randy Newman and Steve Martin, and it was about to go into production with John Landis directing. Meanwhile, there was the failure of The New Show. Not only did it sort of fail, noble failure though it was, but it was enormously costly, which I had to bear personally. This was the first time I was producing a show for a license fee. We were deficiting it, and I was losing $100,000 a week. We did 11 of them. When it was all over, what I focused on was behaving well. I felt I'd had such enormous success with Saturday Night that it was character building to have that kind of failure. I had won big, and now I was losing. The last thing I wanted to do was go back and do a television show, but there was a very strong financial reality. I won't say I was completely broke, but I was pretty close to it. I wasn't in any danger of going under, and I'd had lots of periods in my life when I didn't have much money. It was more the dealing with the failure. And then I was getting divorced later on in that year. By the spring of 85, when Three Amigos started shooting, Brandon called me and asked me about coming back. Dick had just decided not to. I said I didn't think so. I think he'd had discussions with Buddy Mora, Billy Crystal's manager, about Billy being the sole host, at least for 10 of them, or something like that. As with a lot of things with Brandon, I only know the part that I heard. Jobs like his are always about making sure you have options. When I left in 80, I just thought it would go away. I never really thought of it as having a life of its own, because I'd been there at the beginning of it. Someone very powerful told me, "You don't want to do Saturday Night Live. Someone who wants to be you wants to do Saturday Night Live." I thought about that a lot. I promised Brandon that he and I would talk again, and then I think we got to a point in the conversation that he was going to pull the plug on the show. And for me, that was the swing vote.
Ann Beats, writer. Lorne called and asked me if I wanted my old job back. It was a compliment, I guess. I said no. I've sometimes regretted that, but I was working on other stuff and being in L.A. more. His first year back didn't seem to go that well. I certainly wouldn't pass judgment on what it represented that he returned.
Tom Schiller, writer. In the early days, I was pretty much left alone. I could go into a meeting and say, "I want to do a thing with John Belushi as an old guy. He does this and that." And then they'd say, "Great, do it." I'd write a script and go around and show it to people. Herb Sargent usually added a line or two to make it better. Then I just shot it, and in 2 weeks it would be on the air. It was a dream come true. But later it became difficult. After the 5-year gap, I went back and worked there a little bit, but it was murder. They assigned some young writer to work with me, and it was bad. They had more checks and balances, and that was bad. Somebody said Lorne had become the corporate person that he used to make fun of. It became more of a business. Suddenly there was a guy with a clipboard walking around while you were writing your sketches and stuff, making sure you were working. When the show first started, no one knew what was going on, and there was a wonderful flux period which was incredibly creative. We were more individuals in the early days. Then, in 85, the show had coalesced, and you found you were just an interchangeable part. Not that the drugs were good, but there were no more drugs. It was clean. It wasn't as rambunctious. That's the word. Andy Breckman, writer. It had meant nothing for me to please Dick Ebersol or to have Dick Ebersol say, "That's funny," to get his seal of approval. He was a suit, more of an administrator. He never once made me laugh. So creatively, I didn't respect the man. On the other hand, I was born in 1955. So in my early 20s, SNL was so influential, so big, and Lorne Michaels was this mythical, legendary figure, that when I started working for him, making him laugh and having a pat on the back from him meant a great deal to me. I was surrounded by writers who had come back to the show and were very cynical about him. They would always be telling Lorne stories about his miscalculations, his posing for the press, his lying to the press, and Lorne supposedly taking credit for stuff that he might not have been entitled to. Clearly they didn't feel the same way about working for Lorne that I did. Bernie Brillstein. Lorne didn't want to go back with the same type of show Ebersol had. There were no long discussions. Lorne just said, "Here's what I'm going to do. Here are the people I'm going after." Robert Downey Jr. was one of the people he really wanted, and it wasn't a terrible idea, but it wasn't a good idea either in retrospect. It just didn't work, and there were a few problems among the cast. I mean alcohol and drugs and whatever. It wasn't good. But Lorne was still young then, 39 or 40, and he was trying something different. John Lovitz, cast member. I'd only had one job in 7 years. Doing the paper chase in its second year on cable when I was 25. So now I was 28. I mean, I just couldn't believe I got the show, you know? Like you go, "You want me to do the Master Thespian?" I'd done it at the Groundlings, but originally when I was 18. I was like just goofing around, you know, saying, "I'm the Master Thespian." And now they've built a whole set for it, you know? It just blew my mind. Or doing The Pathological Liar. And the next thing you know, everybody's imitating it. It was just unreal, because I'd been working as a messenger. And then I finally started working, and I got a movie and a series, then I got Saturday Night Live. I mean, I was broke. And then by the end of the year, I got a deal to do a movie for $500,000. So that was just an amazing time for me, you know, amazing. Well, everybody else went nuts. Everyone else started getting weird, and I was like, what's going on? I got the job, you know, and then a friend of mine sent me a book of quotes, and he underlined a quote from Kirk Douglas, and it said, "When you become famous, you don't change. Everybody else does." That's what was happening in my life. Everybody had said no for 7 years, and all of a sudden everybody was saying yes, and I couldn't believe it. Anthony Michael Hall, cast member. I grew up watching Eddie and Piscopo and that cast from that era. I was just a kid at the time, and I was just enjoying what was happening to me, working on the John Hughes films. And then all of a sudden I got a call from Lorne and, you know, I was in shock. I was such a huge fan of the show and so many of the actors and actresses that emerged from it, so it was really an honor. Even after I had decided to do the show, I remember walking around the city, just baffled that I had taken this on. I couldn't believe I was actually going to be a part of it. It really is one of the most creatively demanding mediums to work in, because it's a blend of a lot of things. Theater and rock and roll and everything else. Dick Ebersol, NBC executive. I think Lorne's first year back in 85 was very dark. It was a very dark year. It was the roughest season Lorne ever had doing the show, and everybody came out of the woodwork to attack. It was the first time he'd ever been subject to that Saturday Night Dead stuff. And that just reminded me that I had left of my own volition, because when I did the show, I'd never gone through a diatribe year like he went through then. Anthony Michael Hall. It was one of the most forgettable seasons of the show's history. I certainly didn't make a major impact on the show like a lot of people did. But just to be a part of it from my standpoint was amazing. It's far and away the most competitive environment I've ever worked in. Some guy who was based in the West, a fan of the show, would send me tapes of selected sketches where it was so blatantly obvious that I was reading cue cards. He had time to do an edited version of, like, my worst cue card readings, the ones that were most blatant. It didn't bother me. I thought it was hilarious. Tom Hanks. It was a sort of cobbled-together cast. Lorne put it together in like 6 weeks. Franken and Davis were back as writer-producers. I think they'd been gone. So it was definitely a sense that the whole staff was either finding their bearings for the first time or trying to refine their bearings after an extreme absence. But in some ways, it was one of those years that Saturday Night Live showed itself to be this enduring show business tradition, this entity, this classic thing, because you could easily say it should have been off the air. That's what everybody wanted it to be. You know, Saturday Night Dead. How often did you read that by the time I was on the show for the first time? Al Franken, writer. The 85-86 season was difficult for a number of reasons, one of which was that Tom Davis and I were nominally the producers, but didn't have that much authority. The second was, we had a cast that didn't gel, and it was very hard to write in the same way as for a cast that had worked. I don't know what was happening in Lorne's head when he put that cast together, but I think he was consciously going after youth. We didn't have enough people to play middle-aged males. It was impossible to write a Senate hearing. I liked Denitra Vance very much, but it turned out she was dyslexic and couldn't read cue cards on the air. I remember her agent or manager coming to us and saying, "You wrote for Eddie Murphy, why aren't you writing for her?" And I said, "Eddie Murphy's Eddie Murphy and Denitra's Denitra. Just because they're black doesn't mean they're the same thing." It was a little out of control. But we had Lovitz, who was great, and Dennis Miller started coming in and doing update, so the building blocks were definitely there. But it was a tough year. Youthful problems, attitude, absence of skills, not to mention what may be a case of talent lack. That confluence made it very, very hard for a talented group of writers to find stuff to do. When the show is doing well, it's usually overpraised, and when it's not doing so well, it's over-criticized. Lorne Michaels. Jim Carrey never auditioned for me personally. There is an audition tape which we almost played on the 25th anniversary show. If he had come that night, we would have. We have all the audition tapes. Carrey, I think, auditioned for Al Franken the year I was executive producer, and Tom Davis and Al were the producers, along with Jim Downey. In 85, when Brandon got me to come back, his whole argument was I had to learn how to delegate. Dick had run it successfully that way, and so Tom, Al, and Jim did their stuff, and I sort of approved things. But later that season, when Brandon was again thinking about canceling the show, he told me, "You have to completely take charge of everything again."
Carol Leifer, writer. Jim Downey and Al Franken were really the people who hired me. Jim had seen me doing Letterman pretty regularly around that time, and he came in and saw me at the comic strip and then just asked me if I wanted to join the staff. Of course I had to meet Lorne to officially be hired. The meeting was like 30 seconds. I walked in. It wasn't even a sit-down meeting. And he said, "Jim and Al said some really good things about you. Are you familiar with what kind of goes on with the writers? It gets pretty intense. Are you prepared for that kind of thing?" I said, "Yeah, I'm down with it." And that was about it. What I realized later was, having been Jim and Al's person coming in, I was never going to be in the inner circle, because Lorne wasn't the one who found me.
Terry Sweeney, cast member. I think Lorne hired me because I was funny. I don't think he hired me as a gay guy. I don't find Lorne homophobic at all. I think he deserves credit. He was the first. When he told me he was going to hire me, I said, "You know I'm going to be openly gay. I'm not going to hide it or pretend I'm not." And he was totally fine with that. I never got the vibe from him that he was homophobic in the least. James Downey, writer. We opened the season with Madonna hosting the show, and there was tremendous hype. It was an offensive, dreadful show. I don't know how many shows there have been, more than 500. I would say the Madonna show has got to be considered one of the top five. I mean, in an entirely negative way. It really crippled the season from the get-go, particularly since there were a lot of people anxious to see that new group of actors fail. That first show was like an albatross for us. Years later, people would still say, "I haven't watched the show since that Madonna thing." It did so much long-lasting damage. When we left in May of 1980, we averaged something like a 12 rating and a 36 share, something pretty high like that. And then after Gene Dumanian's third show, it was consistently halved. So it was like a 7 rating or something. When Ebersol did the show, he stabilized it and solidified it and kept it on the air, which I think he deserves a lot of credit for. But the numbers were never really huge. That Madonna show got like a 10 rating. That was big. It was almost like, the bad news is, a lot of people were watching. Robert Smigel, writer. I wrote a song for Madonna to do in a Spanish talk show sketch, and it was surreal because she was the biggest star in the world, and I was just stepping into this show for the first time. I'd half-written this sort of medley for her to sing, and I was one of the backup singers in the sketch. It was a very, very strange way to start. Then I didn't get anything on for 4 weeks, and I was worried about getting fired, because the show was such a disaster. George Meyer was a great writer, who took me under his wing, and he told me, "Don't worry. No matter what, Lorne doesn't fire people. He gives them a chance." But after about 5 shows, people started telling me, "Things are tough, and the network's clamping down." Damon Wayans, cast member. The thing about Madonna was she was terrified. She had never done this before. They were doing the 5, 4, 3 countdown for the show to come on live. And I looked over at Madonna and she had the biggest facial tic, like her skin was jumping off. One of her eyes was like jumping off her face. She was a wreck. Madonna's not the friendliest person in town, but she was very, very professional. And throughout the week she kept saying, "Let's do it again. Let's rehearse it again. Let's rehearse it again." She worked her ass off. Jack Handy, writer. The Madonna show was considered in bad taste. It was viciously attacked, and the ratings started going down. We were actually worried. That was 1 year, I think, that people wondered whether the show was going to get canceled. But we had a good writing staff then, with people like George Meyer and Jim Downey and Franken and Davis. Terry Sweeney. Chevy hosted the second show, and we were also excited because to us Chevy was like a god. This was someone returning who'd been one of the original people and was this legendary figure. And we were just excited to work with him. And when he got there, he was a monster. I mean, he insulted everybody. He said to Robert Downey Jr., "Didn't your father used to be a successful director? Whatever happened to him?" "Boy, he sure died. You know, he sure went to hell." Downey turned ashen. And then Chevy turned to me, and he said, "Oh, you're the gay guy, right?" And he goes, "I've got an idea for a sketch for you. How about we say you have AIDS and we weigh you every week?" It was out of place. So then he ended up having to apologize and actually coming to my office. He was really furious that he had to apologize to me. He was just beside himself. And it was just awful. He acted horribly to me. He acted horribly to everyone. When he got on the elevator at the end of the night, you know, we all go to the party afterwards, and everybody saw him coming, we hid. We wouldn't be on the elevator with him. We were all hiding. We were plastered against the wall, going, "Oh, he's getting on the elevator. He's almost gone. Oh, he's gone." No one wanted to be near him. I don't know what he was on or what was happening to him mentally, but he was just crazy. John Lovitz. When Chevy Chase was hosting, there was a meeting of the writers and staff. So Chevy looks at Terry Sweeney and goes, "You're gay, right?" Terry goes, "Yes, what would you like me to do for you?" Chevy goes, "Well, you can start by licking my balls." Anthony Michael Hall. I never knew that side of Chevy. Then again, to Chevy, I was probably always the kid who played his 14-year-old son in National Lampoon's Vacation. He was always nice to me. I really had a good experience. Ron Reagan, host. I went and saw Lorne at the Chateau Marmont, where he was staying. He was getting ready to go to some award show. We sat and talked for about a half an hour or so about me hosting the show. Initially, I was really just doing him a courtesy of telling him no to his face. They'd called before to ask if I wanted to host the show, and I'd said no. And then he was going to be in L.A., and he said, "Why don't you come over and talk?" I said, "Well, okay, fine." I just expressed my concern about I didn't want to be taken advantage of in some way, and didn't want to see my family hurt because of my stupidity, going on to a show where it was really an opportunity to make fun of them, and in a cruel way, not a fun way. And Lorne just said, "We don't want to do that. That's not what we're about." And he promised I'd have final say over things. Nothing too awful was going to get by me. And that pretty much addressed my concern. Once I'd realized I'd have control, that was it. I said okay. It just seemed like a fun thing to do. Who at that age wouldn't want to host Saturday Night Live? Anthony Michael Hall. People were pretty impressed by the job Ron Reagan did hosting the show. He was very willing to throw it up there to see what stuck, you know? He was quite fearless as an actor, I thought. And he really had a good sense of humor about his upbringing and his family and everything. I thought it was really cool. Ron Reagan. I think that once they got to know me a little bit, everybody was being fairly careful about not being cruel. To have family members sitting there, it takes a little bit of the edge off. You can't be too mean. I'm probably as far or farther left than anybody on that cast. So in terms of personal politics, nobody was going to outleft me. There's always a little bit of weirdness. I've discovered in my life, having been my father's son for years and years, that people have preconceptions about you, and you try to disabuse them of those pretty soon. We actually rehearsed one sketch that had been my idea. When we were sitting around the table earlier in the week, I said to everybody that I thought it would be funny if Terry Sweeney and I did a kind of Screaming Queen sketch. And we wrote one up and kind of put it together and did it in the dress rehearsal. And you could kind of see the audience was really just sort of confused by it. didn't really see the point. Terry Sweeney. In one sketch, Ron and I played these gay guys who were house-sitting for Nora Dunn in her apartment, and we just change everything around and redecorate and do all this stuff, and he played the really flamingest queen in the world. But they cut the sketch. His manager made him cut it. But he was still a great host. Ron Reagan. The risky business sketch seemed like an obvious one. I got a little note from Tom Cruise afterwards, just saying that he enjoyed the sketch and thought it was really funny and ha-ha. A little polite note. And yet there were some people who were upset by it. I don't really understand why. I guess it was just the jockey shorts. I was actually wearing 3 pairs of jockey shorts. Every time we rehearsed and right after the dress rehearsal, standards and practices would come back and say, "Could we put another pair on him?" My parents were probably not thrilled that I was going to be doing something that would inevitably poke some fun at them. I don't think my dad really cared, but Nancy tends to get a little nervous about that sort of thing. Terry Sweeney. Ron said his mother did not care for my impression of her, but he thought I was eerily accurate. Ron thought I was more like his mother than his mother was, so I thought that's the highest compliment one can ever have. He was great. He used to call to me, "Hi, Mom," in the halls. Imagine how freaky it must have been for him. There's a man coming down the hall dressed as your mother in the same red Adolfo suit going, "Hello, dear. Hello, son." Ron Reagan. Later on, I was in New York for something completely unrelated, and I stopped by the Saturday Night Live offices to just say hi, and they were in the midst of doing a show where Oprah was guest host. And they were having their first cast meeting with her in Lauren's office when I happened to knock on the door. I didn't know what was going on. I just came in to say hi. "Oh, come on in, come on in. Sit in on the meeting." So I did. I turned around and said hi to Oprah, who I really didn't know at the time. She wasn't as humongous as she is now. And I could tell she was really displeased I was there. It was like I'd really stepped into her thing. So I stayed just a few minutes and politely left. Al Franken. We had some good things that season, like when Ronald Reagan Jr. did the show, and Pee Wee Herman did a funny show. Lovitz started doing The Pathological Liar, and Joan Cusack was tremendously talented. They were bright spots. It's just that nothing else went right.
Carol Leifer. I wrote a sketch about a husband and wife having an anniversary dinner. It's just basically, "We love each other so much. It's so great, our anniversary. And, you know, isn't it wonderful we can just tell each other anything? That's how close we are." And at that point, the husband goes, "That's so true. Here's something. Sometimes I have this fantasy that you die." Tom Hanks eventually did it, but it literally went through every read-through of every male host and got cut. When Tom Hanks did it, it was so great. Otherwise, it was a terrible year. That was, I think, maybe the only year where at the end of the season the show certainly was not guaranteed to come back. It seemed genuinely in danger of being canceled.
Terry Sweeney. It was an unhappy time during that period for a lot of the actors and actresses involved, but I've heard from future casts that they were not so happy either. There was a lot of Al and Tom, definitely. Al Franken and Tom Davis were very much involved in the show and very hands-on and very opinionated. So I think that they had their own version of things. I think they had felt like, "We're back," and rolled up their sleeves. And I think Al very much wanted to be on the show, and now he's found his little niche, which is wonderful for him, but I think he was still looking then for what his niche was. What was his claim to fame, and how could he move from being a writer to being on camera, being up front? Tom Hanks. Hosting the first time is a very, very milliclose second to the first time you appear on the Johnny Carson show. You're that combination of absolutely petrified, but also kind of dizzy. The whirlwind preparation that goes into that first week, if you've never done it before, is kind of mesmerizing. It honestly looks as though nothing is happening at first, You know, you're the host, and you're just kind of escorted around and around and around, and you're getting your picture taken, you're getting fitted for something, and people come up to you and pitch ideas that you might or might not understand. And then on Wednesday, you have that big long read-through that, for some reason, starts a full hour and a half late, and then goes for about 3 hours, and then, from that, they cull all these things. You read 25, 30, 40, 50, 600 pieces, I can't even remember. Then you go into this room, and they have them all up there on cards posted to a bulletin board, and the next thing you know, you decide what's going to be on the show. So that by the time you get through that, that moment, which, by the way, is after the full dress rehearsal, you've sort of done it already. But now you know that it's live. I mean, it's horrifying. And yet it's the most exhilarating thing. Like being strapped inside of a huge explosive rocket ship and you're waiting for the countdown to go and it just might blow you to kingdom come, or it might take you to the moon. The thing that happens the first time you do the show is you're just completely swept away with the history of the place. I think there's still stuff tacked up onto bulletin boards that hasn't moved in 17 years or so. So you're reading these things that have been up forever in hallways lined with all those photographs. But when you go down and you're actually on in Studio 8H, you're thinking, you sort of recognize this place, but you can't believe it's as small or as crowded or as dark as it is, and that the band is actually playing as loud as it is. The first time I did it, it was just the beginning of the Christmas season, so it was December and they were lighting the Christmas tree there in Rockefeller Center. And the offices of Saturday Night Live were like one extremely big and confusing family. Everybody who had kids brought them in, and everybody was staring out the windows of the 17th floor, looking down at the big tree and watching it all on TV at the same time. The show was, of course, a history of entrances and exits. Sometimes the entrance was momentous and the exit ignoble. Sometimes the exits were en masse. Many of the show's stars left only to return sporadically in cameo roles. They were like alumni revisiting the campus of their youth. No one ever actually quit on the air while the show was actually in progress, or not quite. Damon Wayans came close, with one of the most memorable exits in the annals of exiting. Andy Breckman. I wrote a sketch for John Lovitz called Mr. Monopoly. The idea was he was a lawyer, and you know the character from the Monopoly board, the character that they draw on the Monopoly game, the little man with the hat. The idea for the sketch was John Lovitz was that man, Mr. Monopoly, and he was a very successful lawyer because he had all these get-out-of-jail-free cards. His clients would go to jail, and he would come in with these cards, and the cops would hate him. Damn you, Mr. Monopoly! And that was the idea for the sketch. And Lovitz was very funny. And Damon Wayans I wrote as a cop who had one line. He would say, "Hey Larry, your lawyer is here to see you." That was it. Dress rehearsal went fine. I didn't know any of the political bullshit that was going on, but I did know Damon had been angry about various things, including something apparently that was cut at dress rehearsal. And he was furious, and he decided between dress and air he was going to quit Saturday Night Live right then and there. He was fed up. And this is how he quit. During the live show, he made his entrance in the sketch not as a cop, but as his flamboyant Queen Gay character that he later did on In Living Color. He came in prancing and delivered, "Your lawyer's here to see you," very swishy. He totally derailed the sketch completely. The audience was completely thrown. What's a gay cop doing in there? Is it about the cop, or is it about Lovitz? It was just stunning. I was with Lorne watching, and Lorne turned to me and said, "That's it. I've got to fire him." Lorne had no choice. Damon had sabotaged a sketch live on air, and Lorne fired him that night, which is what I think Damon wanted anyway. I was just sitting in the corner thinking, "I'm sorry. I supplied the bullets." And then I was going to disappear at 1 o'clock forever. I remember Tom Davis, who I guess was also a guest writer or was just hanging out there, saying, "I'll bet anyone in this room that within 3 years we will all be standing in line to see a Damon Wayans movie. This is not the end of his career." And he was right. That was the start of his career. Damon Wayans. What was I supposed to do? I was supposed to just be a cop. But I was frustrated because I think Lorne Michaels thought he was protecting me by not putting me out there, letting me do my thing. So I started walking around wearing dark shades. When they asked me what was wrong, I said, "It's too wide in here. It hurts my eyes." I was really on the verge of a nervous breakdown, or just taking a gun and killing everybody. The night in question, the Mr. Monopoly sketch, I didn't think the sketch was that funny. I thought it was a one-joke premise. I was supposed to play a cop, and we were doing a takeoff on, like, Miami Vice. This was the hot show at the time, and I was supposed to be Tubbs, and Randy Quaid was playing the other guy. So between dress and air, they pushed that button. I wore a suit, so I thought, at least I'll look good in the sketch. And then between dress and air, Lorne Michaels comes to me and goes, "The sketch is not working. You look like a pimp." It was because of me the sketch wasn't working. He wanted me to wear a uniform. So I just got angry, because I didn't think the sketch was funny. I had a bunch of straight man lines. It was the fact that Lorne blamed me for the sketch not being funny when I had told him before that it was a one-joke premise. The guy's waiting to get out of jail, and Mr. Monopoly comes in and gives him a get-out-of-jail-free card. That was the big joke. It's like 12 minutes until Mr. Monopoly finally walks in. And then they say the reason it wasn't working was that I looked like a pimp at dress rehearsal. And I just said, fuck it. I was like, okay, I'll be a cop in uniform, but I'm going to find a character. And it would have been funny if I had not done it with such anger. I was so angry, I basically wanted them to fire me. I wanted to quit, but I thought they would sue me. It was the Brillstein Gray Management Company trying to manage everything at one time, as opposed to getting on with my needs. They were representing Lorne. Lorne was the big dog. Lorne Michaels. Damon broke the big rule. I went berserk. The whole business of trust when you're in an ensemble, the whole deal with the network, in my mind, is that we operate on the level of trust. We have live air. We're not just going to go up there and say, fuck, 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 fuck. And I think Damon, in his defense, he didn't get a big enough laugh with what he was doing, and he went back to a character that he'd done in Beverly Hills Cop. Damon Wayans. I'd never seen Lorne lose his cool. He had always been very logical and reasonable, and we could talk about anything. But he came backstage, and he was like, "Get the fuck out of here! Who the fuck? What the fuck?" It was like talking to friends up in Harlem. He was cussing. He was like, "John Belushi never did anything like that. You'll never work in show business." He said that one to me. Or never work again in New York, whatever. I didn't even say goodbye. I went home, gladly. It was the same management, so they were basically telling me, "You fucked up, this is it, word is going to spread," and all that. In hindsight, I understand that, but I was a young kid. I didn't understand politics or how tough it was for Lorne Michaels coming back for his first year and how he wanted to be right and be the guru of comedy. I didn't understand any of that. All I understood was I wasn't funny and they wanted me to hold a spear. Terry Sweeney. I think the writers came to think of me as just the gay guy. They'd go like, "Oh, well, he's a hilarious gay guy, so if we want a gay guy, we'll just put him in this sketch, where the guy can be really effeminate. The guy's really gay. But if it's a regular role, let's give it to John Lovitz or Randy Quaid, who were very talented. But it's just a question where I would feel like, hey, I can do this too." So I think I felt the brunt of some prejudice. Later on, I came to realize, as one matures, one realizes it's not always the homophobia. It's a lot of times just that's not your world. If you're straight, you're thinking about a straight guy and a husband, and it's just not something you're thinking about. You think that you find a gay guy over there and a straight guy's over here, and it doesn't occur to people that they're ever in the same place.
Carol Leifer. I really don't think during the season Lorne said much of anything to me. I never requested to speak with him by myself. I'm different now. If I'm getting the cold shoulder from somebody, at that time I'd stay out of your way. But now I want to investigate more to see how I could help the situation. I do remember a very valuable Lorne lesson that I still use today. I remember him really clearly in one meeting saying he always hated the funny name joke. You know, when a character had a funny name, like a punny name, that kind of thing. It's such an indicator of an amateur.
Damon Wayans. I was so glad to be off the show. I was so relieved. I finally felt like I lived on the edge. My problem with that show is, and I used to say it all the time, we're so rehearsed, where's the thrill of being on live? I had an improv background, hung out with Robert Townsend and my brother and Eddie Murphy. We'd go on stage and play around, and I didn't feel we were doing that on SNL. And the group of actors that they had, great actors, but they weren't improvisational actors. You say a different line during rehearsals, and they go, cut! What about playing around? So when I got fired, I was thrilled. I was relieved. I had knots in my stomach, I was angry, and I would cry when I got home. But, you know, to Lorne's credit, he's never spoken bad of me. I think in his mind he respected me or something. He's actually given recommendations for me in films and stuff like that. And that was right after this happened.